The Guardian Long Range Match at King Bee Farm, this week on Mail Call Mondays. Welcome to another Mail Call Mondays. I'm John McQuay with 8541 Tactical, and we're here with my lovely wife, Sarah. And this week, we are going to talk about our experience at the Guardian Long Range Match at King Bee Ranch, or King Bee Farm, in Ardmore, Tennessee. And that was this last weekend, which was August 25th. And we've talked to you guys about Guardian Long Range Matches before. Those of you that are longtime viewers of the show have seen quite a few after-action reports from these matches. And the matches tend to be a little bit of a different kind of format in the long-range precision rifle competition world. One of the big things about the Guardian matches is it just has a different vibe, a different feel to it. While most precision rifle matches are welcoming to new shooters, the Guardian match really goes above and beyond to bring in new shooters and make them feel comfortable and provide them the support and the help that they need to have a successful match. Now, a successful match may not mean that you win the match, but to have fun and really enjoy it and to be able to safely conduct themselves throughout the match. So this Guardian was no different, but I tell you what, this is the first time that we've shot at the King Bee Farm, and it was an absolutely fantastic facility. What did you think?
It was kind of like the High Rollers Shooting Club. There was facilities, like there was running water and air conditioning, some beautiful buildings. The grounds are absolutely gorgeous. Kind of storybook-like. So it was an amazing facility, and I hope that they will host another Guardian next year because it was just a wonderful place to shoot at.
Now, this Guardian match was only a one-day match. Mm-hmm. The last one we shot was a two-day. And I think one-day matches of this format really work well because you can just get it all out on day one. You don't have to worry about keeping any in reserve for day two. The facility allowed all the shooting points to be relatively close together. There's a little bit of a walk from the car out to the shooting points. But once you were there, we had eight stages, and you just basically rotated with your squad from one stage to the next stage to the next stage. And it was really nice because there was really not a lot of downtime. There was downtime where you were sitting and waiting for your turn to shoot, but the whole time people were shooting. Nothing is more frustrating than going to a match where you travel a good distance, you get there, and then you just sit and wait, and there's no one shooting. That wasn't the case here. They had, 60 shooters?
I think 69 shooters.
So, 69 shooters.
Yeah.
So, 69 shooters for this match, and they went through them relatively quickly. So that was really nice. It was also beneficial for us because Ardmore is only about 3.5 hours away from us. So it was very easy for us to drive down the night before, shoot the match, and then drive back that evening. Now, the start of the match, the match briefing took place in the barn that they had there at King Bee Farm, and calling it a barn is really, really understating it. It appeared to be a barn on the outside, but it was more of a gathering hall. There was an altar in there, and that you could definitely tell it was used for wedding receptions and that. So very, very nice place. Had a little bit of a rustic feel to it, but everything was updated and modern and really nice. We walked from there up to the firing point. Again, you had to drag all your gear from the car, from the parking spot, down to the barn for the briefing, and then back up to the shooting positions. So if you did have some kind of physical disabilities, it might have been a good idea to load your stuff up into a wagon, but most of us just threw on our packs and hauled our gear on our backs to where we needed to go. Once we got to our shooting positions, they broke us up and told us what stage we were going to start on. And our squad started on stage number 5, which was called Sling and Stone Gunfighter. And this actually, this stage probably used more LaRue targets than I have seen on any other stage on a competition. There were actually 10 10 LaRue targets on this stage. So those of you that have never shot a LaRue target before, I'll give you a real quick breakdown. They are a modular target system. They are electronic, and it is a knockdown steel with a motorized lift on it. So the target system is all self-contained. It's not radio controlled or anything. And what happens is it will raise the steel into an upright position. When you hit, the steel will drop, and then the motor will sense the steel went down and it will raise the target back up into a firing position again. So it's very, very obvious when you hit it. There's a big armored bar at the bottom of it protecting all the mechanisms. So if you hear a ding and you don't see a target drop, you hit the armored bar below it. But the goal of this stage, this was a prone stage, and the stage description is: shooter will begin behind the rifle that's staged on the ground with a magazine inserted and bolt back pointed downrange. On the start signal, the shooter will drop down into prone position and engage five pairs of LaRue falling targets from near to far and left to right with one round per target. And the ranges on these were 577, 672, 748, 836, and 906 yards. So from intermediate to longer range. And you had to shoot them left or right so the spotter knew which target you were shooting at, because we did have enough wind that you could be aiming at one target and have your bullet drift into the other target. So you had to shoot them left or right. You couldn't claim a hit when it was really a miss. And the wind really was a big factor out there. This range was relatively open. There was a gap. I didn't get to go down range and actually see the topography down further, but guys that shoot this on a regular basis had told me there's a big gap in the trees about halfway down, and that allows the wind to really come through in that section of the range. And so we had anywhere from 5 to 10 mile an hour wind, and it wasn't a steady wind, and occasionally it would change directions. It would fishtail down the range, or you would lose it completely in the middle of the firing line. Mm-hmm. So not an incredibly fast wind, but just a really tricky wind to spot and to keep your eyes on.
Yep. I wish someone would have told me about the falling targets before, because I thought I broke it. So when I hit the target, I didn't know that they were going to fall, and my initial thought was, oh, that just cost us some money. I figured it out pretty quickly, though. And like John said, the wind was insane. It was luck that was on your side, because you could be holding anywhere from 0.3 to 1 to 1 mil on one thing, and the next you'd be dead on. It was just all over the place. So it gave a little bit of element for those experienced shooters to play with as well. So it wasn't as easy and straightforward as you'd think it would be.
And I came off with only 4 hits on that. And those were on the relatively close range targets. It kind of got in my head a little bit. To back up, the first day we arrived on Friday, and we arrived early in the afternoon because we started down mid-morning on Friday from home. So we got time to get out and have a leisurely time on the zero range, check the zeros on both of our guns. We got a chance to actually walk out to 725 yards and make sure that our dope was on and everything was good with the guns. I made a very slight zero adjustment, a 3/10 left zero adjustment on the rifle. This rifle still is in its break-in period. It had less than 100 rounds down the barrel when we went out there, which is not a good idea if you are serious about winning a match. You don't generally take a fresh barrel out because it can speed up while you're shooting. I don't know if that was a problem. We haven't been able to get out and chronograph it yet, but it is something for those of you that are putting together new match rifles. Make sure you burn some ammo down it before you take it to a match and chronograph it afterwards. But I felt that I had a good zero. I felt I had good dope going out. But I got the 577, I believe, and then I got one, I think, on the 672 and one on the 748. And then I was just off beyond that, and I was having trouble catching any kind of idea of where I was at. So I wasn't sure if it was the wind. I wasn't sure if it was me. I was breaking shots, what felt like good shots. But later on, Daddy though was getting back off of some of the other spotters. I believe I was overcompensating for the wind, and I was shooting off the upwind side on those. So a little bit tricky for me.
It's pretty straightforward. This match was kind of designed to really support the new shooter. Historically, most Guardian matches, you had to hold your firearm, and then when the buzzer rang, you had 90 seconds to get in position with your firearm and go from there. But this one allowed you to set up, spot in on the targets, stand up, get off your rifle, buzzer would go, and then you would have 2 full minutes to engage the targets. So it was kind of new for you to think, okay, slow down and take your time because you have it. So that was this warm-up where everybody was just burning through it, and then they realized, wait a minute, I still have a whole minute left to actually take my time and really adjust what's going on.
Yeah, it was a really nice time limit on it. It did give you the ability to get down behind the rifle and really get in and get good shots. And that's why it was kind of baffling me that I was missing, because I wasn't rushed. I was breaking clean shots. But it is what it is, and you take your points and you stand up and you move on. And we moved on to the next stage, which was stage 6. And this one's called Big and Small Tank Trap. And that's big and small, and then tank trap. The stage description is: shooter will begin behind the rifle that is staged on the ground with a magazine inserted and bolt back pointed downrange. On the start signal, shooter will drop down into the prone position and engage the first pair of big and small targets with one round each, proceeding to the second set of big and small targets, and finally to the falling LaRue target. The shooter will then transition to the tank trap and engage the targets in the same fashion with one round each. So this one, they had a pad next to the tank trap, and this was a smaller tank trap. And you started out, again, rifle on the ground. You dropped in. You fired your shots on the large and then the small targets and progressed out. And then you move to the tank trap. Now, I like stages like this if you're introducing someone to the tank trap, because first of all, you have a nice solid prone position to make sure that you're on the targets. And then when you move to the tank trap, you can very easily see that if your misses are because of your wind call or your dope or whatever, or if it's because of your positioning on the tank trap. So you get a relaxed portion, you can actually grab some points, and then you can move over to the tank trap. And you can have fun there. And this was your first time shooting the tank trap,
wasn't it? So, you know, John, usually before I go, we'll say, what's your plan? And my plan was to take my time and get as many hits in the prone position because it was stable and I was used to it. And then move over to the tank trap and hope for the best. And I did. I got a hit on the tank trap. So to me, at that point, the match was a success because I had accomplished something I had never done before. And it's different for people who are different body sizes. You know, I just squatted and held on, and it was just much like a barricade for me. So it was interesting. Nothing really to write home about.
And on this tank trap, you only had to shoot off the apex of the tank trap. I mean, you could shoot off of whichever side of the tank trap you wanted to shoot off of. But obviously the apex of the tank trap was the most stable. And we were using a Reaser Precision pint-size game changer. They're now available. We got one a little bit before they were available, and I've been beating that guy up. And that was really my main bag that I used for this match. And on the tank trap, it worked really well. It's nice and compact, but because of the way it's designed, it's compact. It's filled with sand. I actually used it as my rear bag on the first stage and then on the first portion of this stage as well, and it worked very well for that. Unfortunately, I didn't work well enough, and I only got 2 hits on this stage.
Okay, wait, stop. He got more than 2 hits, because as he's sitting and he hits the first big plate that was at 408, someone that was on the spotting scope goes, "You killed it, John!" And I thought, wow, he must have done a really good job. He must have really just nailed it dead center. No, there was a bird sitting on top of the plate, and the frag killed the bird. So he got more than 2 hits, just that one didn't count.
Well, and I felt bad about the bird, but the clock was running, and normally our home range here, it's not uncommon to have birds land on your target all the time, and you just shoot around the birds. You just kind of ignore the birds. When they land on your target stand, you shoot the target, the bird gets the idea, and the bird flies off. Well, I didn't stop and think. The bird was actually sitting on the top edge of the plate. So when I hit the plate, the spall killed the bird, and he locked up solid, fell straight off, and then flopped around on the ground. So I felt a little bad about killing the bird. I'm sure, especially since it was, you know, one plate into it, that we could have waited for the bird to leave before I fired the shot. But, you know, so be it. It was kind of, I kind of blocked it out of my mind. But, yeah, it killed him dead. So when you're practicing, be cognizant of the wildlife and try not to kill things that you don't need to kill. But, you know, it was a live fire range, and we had been shooting for quite a bit at that point. So I think that bird may have been feeling a little bad about his lot in life. And
Darwin in action at this point.
So we took him out of the gene pool, so he's not likely to breed more birds that like to sit on steel targets. So that was stage six, and then we moved over. And these stages were inside of a garage type deal. So we had open front to it, enclosed in on three sides, and a really nice roof. They had a refrigerator in there, had some water. And the really cool part is that they have monitors on the back wall, big flat screen monitors. And they had cameras downrange on the 800, 900, and 1,000-yard targets that we'll talk about here in a minute. So it's a really well-built, well-thought-out facility. On each one of the firing points, there were thick rubber mats like you would find in a gym to lay on. So you're not laying on cold, hard concrete. You actually had something to sit on that was or lay on that was pretty comfy. So again, really, overall, very nice facility. So our next stage was stage seven, and this one was called John Rice. And John Rice is a gentleman who was there during this match. And in the morning of the match, he made a world record attempt for a 1,000-yard shot from a paraplegic. So they set up the stage in honor of him, and shooters had to shoot off of the same shooting platform that he utilized to make this shot. So it was a very cool setup overall. The shooting process was not super difficult because it was just basically a bench. You set your rifle on the bench, and it was stable enough that you could put your full upper body weight against the back of the bench and then get on your rifle. However you needed to do so to engage the targets. And the on the start signal, shooters will engage the targets positioned in front of the bright orange sighter steel from a modified prone position, which was the bench, with four rounds per target near to far order. So you could start with 12 rounds in the gun. Most shooters had to do a mag change at some point, but again, there was plenty of time to be able to do it. I believe all of these were two-minute time limit.
Everything was a two-minute time limit.
We don't have the time limits written down on here, but I believe they were all 2 minutes. So the targets, I'll describe them real quickly here. They are full-size IPSC steel hung in basically like a railroad tie frame. But then inside of the railroad tie frame was another plate of steel that was painted orange. So the target was painted white, and then this huge piece of steel behind it was painted orange. It's very, very cool for new shooters because you could shoot, and if you totally missed the IPSC target, very likely you would impact the steel, and you would still see your splash on the orange steel. So if you were off the target, you could still get visual feedback on where you need to correct. And that helped me at least on a couple of targets here where I could see my splash and then correct and then get on. Again, we did have a little bit of a tricky wind down there. And I'm not saying just tricky because I missed. Points were kind of low on this stage and all three of these stages for a lot of shooters out there. So it was a little bit of a tricky course. Now, I could have done a better job and picked up a couple of more points, but it was a little bit of an interesting deal. Now, I will talk about real quick on this. I said most shooters had to do a magazine change or they had to carry a couple extra rounds to throw in. I wouldn't say I cheated, but I had a little bit of an advantage because I'm running an MDT 13 round magazine. So through the entire course of fire, through everything that we did, I had this guy loaded with 12 rounds because the rules didn't prohibit it. So if I had a situation where I had to chuck a live round out or something and continue on, I had spares in here. I didn't have to fumble around in pockets or I didn't have to mess with a 2-round holder on the side of the gun. I just had extra rounds in the magazine.
John wasn't joking when he was talking about the wind on this. This was the only stage I got a goose egg on. So for me, that's an improvement. Like I said, this is the best match I feel like I've shot. And it went from people, the mirage at this point had started becoming so crazy. A boil wouldn't stop to the point where you were shooting out there and there was no call. You couldn't see a trace. And you had one gentleman who held nothing for his first target. And then the second, the 900 target had to hold like 1.2. And then was back to like 0.2 on the 1,000 because the wind was just that crazy. So once you hit a golden spot, people just hammered away, hopefully getting their shots downrange before the wind picked back up.
And it was interesting because there were a couple of flags downrange. This is a golf course and a multi-use area and that. So there are things downrange that you can use as wind cues. So we had a large American flag. We had a Tennessee flag down there. A couple of other actual wind flags here and there.
There were wind flags on these targets.
So you could see that each one of the flags kind of was doing its own thing. Mm-hmm. So it was really interesting to try to pick what your correct wind is and then drive with that. And like she was saying, the mirage was doing all kinds of crazy things. And at points, the spotters couldn't even catch trace. So again, really interesting. But where some people would shy away from those kind of things, I actually wish I had access to that range more often because shooting in those kind of conditions consistently will make you a better shooter. I have the disadvantage of shooting on a shorter, more protected range here at home, so I don't have to encounter high switching winds very often. So that was stage 7. Again, pretty simple in layout. A little bit difficult to get the hits, and 1,000 was the longest distance target that we had for the entire match. And our next stage was one of the ones that really gave a lot of people trouble. This was stage 8, and it was called the Blind Shot. Now, the matchbook was handed out the day before and emailed out the day before, so all shooters had access to this matchbook that we're reading off of. Really well done, really well produced. I wish every match I went to had something like this that they sent out ahead of time. But this stage was intentionally very vague and very ambiguous because it is a blind stage. They don't want you going into it knowing exactly what you're going to encounter. So the stage description is really long. Again, it's ambiguous, so I'm not going to read the stage description. But I will tell you, down here on the bottom, they have this little alien guy and this little combine. And I'll put a picture of this up on the screen so you can see it. And it says, fact number 224, the Chinese aliens ride around in combines. Call, and it's got a phone number, to speak with Mike the expert. Password, combine. Now, I'm going to blur out the phone number because poor Mike has already had more than enough phone communications. He's probably going to end up having to change his phone number there. But guys were calling this phone number starting the night before the match all the way through, talking to Mike, who happens to be at Mile High Shooting Supply, and giving him the password combine, thinking they were going to get some kind of password to the gate or some kind of information on the blind stage. And Mike had no idea why these people were calling him. So it's pretty hilarious. I think Gary's got a little something coming for that.
There's no doubt.
And I think Frank Golly had a little bit of input on this as well, so it's kind of funny. But the stage itself, like I said, it was a blind stage. So the shooters had to stage around the corner where you couldn't see what was going on. They had a marshaling area, and the RO would come out, call the next shooter up, and you would have to bring whatever you needed. The information was that it was going to be a loophole stage, that you were going to have to fire through a loophole to a target. It was one shot and one shot only, though. So knowing it's a loophole, knowing that loopholes can be high, they can be low, they can be back, they can be forward, all kinds of nonsense, and you might have to engage all the way out to 1,000 yards, guys had to select what equipment they were going to take up there, and they had to carry it up with them to be prepared to shoot the stage. So a lot of us went with tripod and arm bag, and then some kind of game changer type bag, some kind of barricade bag to try to figure out. My strategy was I went up with the rifle already clamped in the Really Right Stuff tripod, ready to go. That way, if I had to stand back off of a barricade and shoot through a loophole, then I was good to go there. This rifle performs really well shooting free recoil off of a tripod, so I was fairly certain that if I had to do that, I could just lock the guy in, get as much off the rifle as I could, and trigger the shot and be good to go. But I went ahead and carried the pint-size game changer as well and my arm bag just to be on the safe side. Well, as I roll up there, none of that was needed. Not any of it at all. The loophole was actually a piece of cardboard with various ports cut in it, set on a deck far enough back that you could put your whole rifle up on the deck, put your bipod down at an appropriate height. There was a wood bar across the bottom of it, so you had to raise your bipod up high enough that your muzzle would clear the wood bar. But then I was able to flip the pint-sized game changer on its side and get it underneath the buttstock and get just a bench rest stable position. Now the target, they did give us a picture of the target beforehand. There was a little cardboard cutout of it, and it was just a head and shoulders, just basically a bust type target. And again, I'll throw up a picture of what the target was. Although everybody loved the stage so much, the cardboard cutout got slightly modified before I was able to take a picture of it. But that was what the target was. When you rolled up, as soon as the time started and you threw your stuff up there, they told you what the range to the target was, which was 326.
I think it was 342. And okay. I only remember that because, well, we'll talk about that in a minute.
I didn't actually write it down because I went up with my Kestrel set in range card mode, so I could really quickly just scroll down to where I needed to be, dial it on the scope, and then shoot. And this is a large target, and it was under 400 yards. Mm-hmm. And so from a bench rest position, it was just a big old meatball. It was an easy hit. They told you where the target was at, but it wasn't super easy to find. I did take a little bit of time and have to pull back my magnification to try to locate the target. And then once I saw it, pulled in and dinged it.
So the part of the stage John didn't touch on is that the RO could only answer yes or no questions. And so the clue she said is the American flag was 342 yards. And I was like, okay, so I found the American flag. And then I found the target who was like peeking out from a bush, and it appeared closer than the American flag. So I was like, okay, so now in my head, I have to figure out the distance between the American flag and the target and compensate for it. So I was like, is it more than 300? And she's like, yeah. Is it more than 325? She's like, yeah. So now in my head, I'm between 342 and 325. So I start naming off numbers. And then my husband, who is allowed to film because he had already taken his shot on the stage, was like, she told you the range. I was like, oh. So it was a little good exercise on communication and what is sent may not be what is received. Yeah. I got a hit. He got a hit. It was one target worth 3 points. It had nothing to do with a combine at all.
And Brittany McMillan was actually the RO on this stage. And she, I'll play a clip here of the data that she gave you or the information that she gave you. But basically, it was between the flagpole and the berm, the target is this distance. And again, people were just, their brains were running 90 miles a minute and way, way overthinking it. But most shooters, once they located the target, didn't have any problem shooting. Some shooters had some significant problems and missed a little portion of the information along the way and either engaged the wrong targets, mm-hmm. were not able to find the targets, or just totally did a brain dump by the time they went up there. But blind stages are really kind of interesting because they limit the amount that you can game the stage. If you have plenty of time to watch a squad go through a stage, then you can kind of get an idea of what worked and what didn't work. And by the time you go up there, you can come equipped exactly with what you need for the stage. But reality, if we try to equate this to tactical shooting, which I try not to put competition and tactical shooting in that same basket, but if we equate it to tactical shooting, when you go into a hide site, you don't know what you have. You have to make do with what you have there, and you have to roll into that hide site with the gear that you think you may need for just about any conceivable condition. So for that reason, I kind of dig blind stages. I don't have a real comfortable feeling about them. I get a little bit nervous about them because I don't know what I'm going to encounter. But the basics will generally help you through. Again, things like a tripod, although I didn't use it on this, if they changed it just a little bit and told you that you couldn't touch the deck, then the tripod would have been invaluable and the tripod would have made the shot. So, you know, it's little stuff like that, being able to be flexible and move on the fly, and attention to detail. So that was blind shot. It was worth 3 points, even though it was only one shot. And as I said, once you actually figured out what you needed to do, engaging the target was not that difficult. There was, for this target, running 6.5 Creedmoor on that large of a target, there was no wind to worry about. Mm-hmm. It was just locate the target and press the shot off. Mm-hmm. So that was stage 8. And from stage 8, we rotated all the way over
We went to the AccuShot Challenge after that. So, you know those great black mats John was talking about in the garage? Well, they had placed some of these mats out on the gravel, so we had a nice place to shoot from. And then the Tennessee sun turned them into boiling lava. So we had the AccuShot cards, everyone's seen them, the Ace, out, and it was at 128 yards. And it wasn't, you got a point towards your score if you broke the reticle, the inner circle of the AccuShot. I did. John did not. And mine was pure luck. I had someone on a spotting scope. The Mirage was so bad at that point that I couldn't even identify which card was mine. So someone on a spotting scope was like, second silhouette, bottom row, first card. I was like, all right, here goes nothing. Pulled the trigger. Mainly because my arms were on fire and I was just ready to get off the mat. But hey, it worked in my favor. So, you know, yay me.
Now, the AccuShot Challenge normally is not that big of a deal. And this one was shot at, 128?
Yeah, 128.
128 yards. Which, again, with the 6.5 Creedmoor, I think I was 1/10 off. It was 1/10 up on my dope for 128 with 100 yard zero. But the Mirage is what made it challenging. I honestly could not see anything other than a black blur. The cards were just like this. This is my card with your number written in the upper right-hand corner here. Now, with the 25 power scope, the Night Force ATACR is absolutely fantastic optically. I would have no problems reading that number at all, finding my card and engage it. When I set my spotter up and looked through the spotter, I could see what card it was. When I got down on the rifle, I could see no numbers. All I could see was moving black blurs. So the Mirage was ridiculous. Now, when I step back and I look at this, I just got down behind the rifle, initially seared my skin on the black mat, went back, dug my shemagh out of my pack, laid it down over top the mat so I had something between my arms and the mat. It was still uncomfortably hot, but I was no longer actually searing the flesh. So I was able to line up and press off a good shot. The problem was the card was dancing up and down so badly that, you know, normally when I have a target dancing, I can watch it and I can see where that lower end was, but it was dancing so quickly I couldn't catch where the bottom of the Mirage was and get a good shot off. I pressed off my shot, felt it was a good shot break, got off of it, walked over, looked at the spotting scope, and saw that I had just grazed the bottom corner. I was happy I didn't miss the whole card, but, you know, that was a minute and a half out of my aiming point, so not happy. Definitely not the accuracy this rig is capable of. So, got everything packed up, and then I stood up and I thought about it. It was absolutely stupid. There were a couple of things that I could have done to do much, much better on that and to minimize the mirage. Now, it's hot as Hades, and you're in the full sun, so that you don't have any control over, but we were on black mats. If I was able to cheat a little bit further forward so that the black mat was middle of my scope and back, and I had the front of my rifle off the mat onto the white and gray rocks, that would have minimized the mirage, because I think most of it was actually coming straight off the mat and wrapping around the barrel, and that was the mirage that I was seeing, not the actual mirage from the grass and the rocks in front of us. So that would have minimized it. Also, running my bipod as high as possible and getting my pump pillow as a rear bag would have picked the rifle up and allowed the mirage to clear a little bit. I would have been out of the heaviest point. I still think the best bet would have been just to push the rifle forward a little bit to try to get the objective forward off that mat. But that's all hindsight. So since I didn't actually cut the center circle on the card, I lost my point for that. And that was only 1 point.
It was only one point, yeah.
So, but I was not alone. A lot of really good shooters also missed the card.
Completely. They didn't even hit the card. Not even... It's just, it was that bad. And again, the little element of challenge for something that seemed really simple.
Yeah, but one of our shooters did get closest to the center, and he ended up getting a certificate for an Atlas bipod. So I really have to thank B&T Industries. They continue to host these AccuShot challenges, and they're absolutely great. Everybody loves them. They're a fun little side match to do. Sometimes they're a side match. Sometimes they're included points in the match. I do like that it was only 1 point, so it really didn't hurt you greatly, although my finish was kind of decided by 1 point. So we'll talk about that here shortly. But after that, we rolled over to Pipe Hunter. Mm-hmm. But one of the things with the AccuShot is as soon as you were done with the blind shot, you were supposed to come over and shoot the AccuShot. That way nobody could tip off somebody else as to what was going on the blind shot. I was the exception because I was running the camera, so they allowed me to shoot it and then go back and get my camera equipment and then come back and film before I went over to the AccuShot. But that's the format of that. And that didn't count as one of the 8 stages. So right. Next, we went over to stage 1, which was called Pipe Hunter. And the stage description for this one is, shooter will stage the rifle on the pipes with the magazine inserted and the bolt open, position pointed in a safe direction. Beginning in the low ready position, the shooter from the shooter box, upon the start signal, the shooter will engage the pig target at approximately 10 yards with 4 rounds using the Ashbury Precision Ordnance custom shot pistol, eye protection required. The shooter will then ground the pistol in the dump bucket and proceed to crawl through the 36-inch drainage pipe, where they'll retrieve their rifle at the end and proceed to engage the animal targets from left to right with 1 shot each, and then re-engage them from right to left with 1 shot each. So this one, you staged your rifle on the ground at the end pipe, magazine in, ready to go, bolt back. On an empty chamber, and then you went over and you grabbed the APO pistol, which was a HK VP9 with RMR mounted on it. Great pistol, very familiar to me. Although I shoot a Glock, you know, it operates very similar to the Glock, and I've shot VP9s in the past. So pretty easy. And again, the pig target was 10 yards, and you had 4 shots, only 4 shots in the magazine. So the slide would lock back, and then you could immediately drop it in the dump bucket and slide down and go for your animal targets. And animal targets was a coyote at 398, a coyote at 286, a coyote at 366, and a pig out at 411. And they really did a number on these, because you had a swing from a coyote target that was way up here to a pig target mm-hmm. that was way down here. And that caused a significant amount of problems for some shooters.
Yeah, I liked the stage. I always like stages that incorporate handguns because it makes you think differently. So, and then the tube, I thought it was going to be a little harder to get through, but it was really smooth on the inside. You could hit your knees and just truly slide, kind of like a kid going down a slip and slide. So the rifle, I couldn't find the, because it was behind, like, or between two hay bales and between two trees. Like, you had to find these landmarks so you could find these little tiny targets out there. The one good thing about these targets is the splash was amazing. There was no doubt to anyone whether you hit it or not. And these were all protected, so you really didn't have to have any wind call on them, except for the pig that was out in the middle of the big open field. But yes, it was a good 45-degree swing, I would say, each way to go back and forth. I had a little malfunction on this one for some reason when I chambered around. It didn't chamber, so I calmed down. I got my shot on and pulled the trigger, and it went click. And so then it just shook me up, and then I had to say, okay, I still have time. Bring it, slow it down, take your time, get your hits. And I got as many as I could. I ran out of time before I could swing back and get the last four.
So this one, the handgun stage, I felt really confident with. I had a good idea of how I was going to address the pipes. I ran my bipod forward on the rail, and I planned on just using the pint-sized game changer under the middle of the rifle and get it set up on the pipe. I don't believe I ran a rear bag or an arm bag on that one, because I planned on pretty much just anchoring the gun on the pipe and not really needing to stabilize the rear of the rifle. So I staged everything, got ready, went over, grabbed the pistol, started at a low ready. And when you're shooting an optics-equipped handgun that you're not familiar with the rake of the grip, it's really important you get your wrist angle, but this is the same kind of start that we use at Steel Challenge with rimfire optics pistols. So you get a good grip on the pistol, you have it down at low ready, you find your dot, and then you look back up at your target. And on the go signal, you just keep that wrist angle locked in and bring your arms up and engage the target. So I was able to get all four hits on the pig really quickly, then dump the handgun and then race through the pipe. Now the pipes are corrugated drainage pipes, the big black plastic pipes. The really nice thing about them is the inside of the pipes are smooth, and it was in an angle. So I just picked up some speed diving into it, hit my knees, and slid out the other side. So there wasn't a lot of crawling involved. It was just a baseball slide through the pipe. Came out the other side, grabbed my rifle, threw the game changer up, and then I kind of had some issues getting the rifle stabilized in. It wanted to dip in to the lows in the pipe, and then I was really having trouble getting the position, and I actually reached up. I believe I jettisoned the bipod on it because it was hanging up on the far side, because it was still deployed from where it was holding the rifle on the ground. So with the setup that I'm running on here, this is a Henderson Precision Arca rail, and Really Right Stuff adapter on the Atlas bipod. So it was just spinning the little thumb wheel on this side and kicking the bipod off, threw it behind me.
You did, and throw it. I remember that.
And then I was able to swing the fore end without hitting the side of the pipe. So that shook me a little bit. I got a couple of misses on my first sweep across. But again, because the targets were backlit, when you hit them, there was really no question that you hit them. The flip side of that was when you missed them, no idea. They were on a stake on top of an engineer stake, and at least two of them were at the crest of the hill. So if you missed, the bullet went over and it would impact somewhere on the backside of the hill and you would never see the impact. So if you didn't actually get a hit, it was no idea. Most of them, though, I felt that my misses were because I was unstable when I broke the shot. So it wasn't where I had to actually try to make a wind call based off the miss. So it was just a quick matter of stabilizing and getting the hit. Swinging across, I had a little bit of a hiccup finding the pig out in the field, but I got a good reference point to larger things around it. So I knew if I was on this, I needed to come over and find the pig. There was a flag out there. There were a couple other targets because it was in the field amongst a bunch of other targets. And they had painted the engineer stakes, I think, orange.
Blue.
On this one? Okay, blue. The engineer stakes were painted blue on this. So you saw a blue stake and a target on top of it. You knew that was what you needed to hit. Also, the ability to crank your magnification down quickly to get a wider field of view. And then when you find your target, dial it back up is really, really important. So cattails, even like the little one that we've got here on the ATACR F1, is a really great thing to have just to be able to spin that mag down and then crank it back up. But overall, I came off with 9 points out of 12 on it and didn't feel too horrible about it.
I don't remember how many I got. I don't commit that stuff to memory. Mine is, did I have fun? And yes, I did, because it's always fun to slide through a pipe on your knees like a kid.
And then after we completed that, we moved over to stage two, which was Humvee TYL. And this is kind of an interesting take on the know your limits type targets. So we had large target to small target at 526 yards. And I'll go through the stage description here, and then I'll tell you the size of the targets. Shooter will start with the rifle in the bed of the Humvee, unloaded with the bolt open and pointed downrange. On the start signal, the shooter will climb into the bed of the Humvee, where they will proceed to engage the TYL targets from the biggest to smallest, right to left. Shooter must hit each target before proceeding to the next smallest target, and upon a miss, must start the sequence over with the largest target before progressing through to the smaller targets. All targets are at 526 yards, and the point allocation is as follows. The 66% IPSC is 1 point, 50% IPSC is 2 points, 33% IPSC is 3 points, and the 4-inch rectangle is 4 points. 10 points possible, and this was unlimited rounds?
It was. 2 minutes, unlimited rounds.
The most points available were 10, so if you made one pass clean, then you got all 10 points. So there was some confusion on how to actually run it, but it's still fairly straightforward. What was more difficult is fitting your body in the back of the Humvee. Now, I'm used to shooting in Humvees and pickup truck beds and that. So unfortunately, you can't use a really good straight behind the rifle position. You usually end up with your knees bent and your feet straight up in the air. The Humvee has a little lip across the bottom of it. So if you're running something like an Atlas bipod, you can get your feet right in behind the lip and you can really load the rifle and get it stable and you can just watch your impacts as you drive through. And on a know your limits or teach your limits or find your limits stage, watching your impacts is really, really important because usually the first plate is a huge meatball plate. And when you get that impact, you want to see exactly where the impact was on the plate. So if you broke a good shot, and you see the impact was on the edge, okay, well, now you can see exactly where your bullet's going to impact, and you just put that point of impact on each one of the next targets as you go along. It was 526. It was, again, out where we did have some wind, but once you got your wind call, you just drove on, and you hammered them as quick as you could. So I lucked out on this one, got a good solid hit on the first target, and then just drove through, and I cleaned it. That was the first stage of the day that I actually cleaned, so I was kind of happy about that.
Yeah, so then the wind decided to come and pay me a visit, and I got stuck on the first plate. Hit the first, second, miss. Hit the first, second, miss. And it just, I could never get off that first plate. There were about two people after me, same luck as him, barely any wind hold, cleaned it. So it truly was, it was a testing, and they would say, you know, give me three more mills, hold three more and or three tenths or whatever, and there was just nothing. Like, so the wind was just it was in that sweet spot in the range where the wind could play with you as much as she wanted to. Yeah.
But I really do like test your limit stages. If you're at a high level match and know your limit stage can break up the field a little bit better, because know your limits, when you miss, you zero it out. On a test your limit stage or a teach your limit stage, generally, you will not zero out. You will just not be able to progress, and you'll have to start over and move on. So again, a fun stage. Some of our taller shooters in our squad had a really interesting time getting back in that Humvee and then folding themselves up so they can get behind it. And I'll tell you, if you are a taller shooter or longer shooter, etc., having something where you are able to move your bipod all the way back closer to the receiver on your rifle is really a great option to have, because if you really don't have a whole lot you can set the rifle on, you can shrink that bipod up and get a little bit more space in the bed of the vehicle for you.
So. Yeah, bless his heart. I believe he said he was 6'9", so his feet were like pretty near touching the roof when he was in there, you know, folded at his knees. They also jokingly said when he went through the pipe, they saw his hands on one end and his feet still sticking out the other. So, each person had their own challenges that come with body size. So it's not just the smaller shooters, but the bigger shooters do have a little bit of a challenge sometimes too.
And he was actually shooting with his wife, Amanda. Mm-hmm. So Clay and Amanda were on our squad, mm-hmm. and they were happy to tell us that, our videos are part of the reason why he got his wife into shooting matches with him.
She did amazing. It was their first match outside of their local matches, and they both did just amazing.
Yeah, so Clay and Amanda, is great shooting with you guys, and hope to see you out at a lot more of these. The next stage was stage 3, and this one is called Dial and Dump.
I literally just got that. Oh my gosh, you guys.
So.
This is awful. Oh. So the stage had a toilet on it, and I just got the dial, and I got the dump part of it. Oh, my word. Oh, sorry.
But you didn't have to dial if you didn't want to dial.
But you could dump if you wanted to, I guess.
So the stage description for this one is, shooter will begin with rifle in hand, magazine inserted with the bolt back. On the start signal, the shooter will move to the toilet, where they must contact it with their body for each shot fired at the 4 targets downrange that must be engaged with 2 shots each from near to far. Mm-hmm. Now, it wasn't just the toilet. It was a toilet, and then they had a mock vanity mm-hmm. set up in front of the toilet with an actual sink in it, and you had to somehow position your rifle across the sink. The toilet was really in an annoying position. I goofed this one up a little bit after I watched some other shooters. After I kicked the toilet, kicked open the lid, almost put my foot in the toilet getting into position, and then got arranged, I put my support side leg, I cocked it up and put the top of my foot across the top of the toilet cover, or the toilet lid, so that I could actually maintain solid contact with it throughout the entire process. And then once I got that little debacle fixed, engaging the targets was fairly straightforward. The 4 targets ranges were 277, 360, 427, and 594. Mm-hmm. Now, the 277 was a rather small target. I can't remember what the exact size was on it.
It was a little rectangle. It was a tiny little guy.
But then they went out from there. It was 8 rounds, 2 on each. And once you actually got into position, it was a fairly straightforward mm-hmm. barricade. Again, just it was a smaller platform that you had to work off. Again, being able to crank my bipod back to the rear of the rifle and then running a bag closer in, I was able to stay on top of it, work on top of it, and get through. This was, again, out where the wind did play a factor. You had to make sure that you got a good wind call and you paid attention to what the wind was doing. And I managed to roll off of that with 5 hits.
I think I got 3. This is again where size matters, because it was like a normal bench rest position for me. And if I'd had a chair, I just put my knee on it. And I've done that before. So to me, this is a very natural feeling position. The bigger gentleman literally sat on the toilet and shot their rifle, which is fun. But it was, the 594 had one of the, hit indicators, mm-hmm. which was really nice. The magneto speed, you hit it and it lights up. So that was really nice. So that when you saw it, there was no doubt that you hit it and do it again, because you got one more shot to go on it.
And that one actually confused me, because nobody bothered to tell me that, they had a T-1000 on there. And when I impacted it, I saw it flash. But then I had to remember, I'm like, wait a minute, what was the flash sequence for a miss? What was the flash sequence for a hit? Because I wasn't solid enough to actually see the bullet impact the target, but I saw it flash. So it caused a little bit of a short circuit. Thankfully, it was the last target, so I just fired my next shot, got a hit on it as well, and then I was done. But it was a little bit of a surprise to hit the target and then see that bright red flash through your optics. So those target hit indicators are absolutely great. I love those things. It's just nice to let your shooters know that, hey, by the way, the target's going to flash when you hit it. So this stage was no end of jokes. Frank Golly over at Sniper's Hide had way, way too much fun with this stage. So that one, again, was fairly straightforward. And then we went over to stage number four. Stage four is the mousetrap. And mousetrap is a generic term for basically a shooter's playset. You'll find these on a lot of the different bigger ranges. This was an extremely, extremely nice and well-built setup.
It really was.
Mousetraps, when they're made of wood, will almost always have some movement and some wiggle in it. The more people you get on them, the more movement there is. So you have to account for that. But I've been on some rickety ones, and I've been on some really solid welded metal ones. This one is right in the middle. It's a really solidly well-built wood one, so all those seams and all those gaps still apply a little bit of movement, but it offers an enormous number of shooting opportunities and positions and ports. They had these little tags that had numbers on them that they would hang over the position that you had to engage in the order that you had to engage it. So the stage description is, shooter will begin rifle in hand, magazine inserted with the bolt back. Upon the start signal, the shooter will move from the top of the steps to the first shooting position corresponding with the number 1 and engage two targets near to far, T2 and T3 from stage 3, with one shot each, and then transition to the three remaining shooting positions identified by their respective numbers on the multiple levels of the prop. Watch your head.
Even I had to duck.
It was very low clearance when you're ducking in. They had actually taken pool noodles and cut them and stapled them or nailed them to some of the lowest hanging boards. Amazingly enough, I did not hit my head. I did smack my muzzle brake coming back down, but thankfully I did not crush my neck running into one of those.
He's got a random bruise from somewhere, too. I'm sure it came from that stage as well.
That I have no idea. Huge bruise on the inside of my thigh. I have no idea where it came from. But the positions started, well, you started with the
it was right at the top of the stairs. Yeah, at the top of the stairs. And it was a fence, like a piece of fencing, about probably 3 feet, if that. And then a little corner, like a deck post. So chain link fence. There we go. Couldn't get the words out. And so that was position 1.
So you started at the top of the stairs because that was on the second level of the mousetrap. You started with the magazine inserted, bolt back, rifle in hand, whatever support gear you would need to shoot through the house. And some guys went overboard. They took tack tables and all kinds of other stuff through there. And you'll see why when we get further on into this. The first position was just a standard barricade position. It was a chain link fence gate, but in the corner there was it was a wood, basically L corner, and it was really stable and it was nice and thin. So I chose to go up, shoot from that position. I dropped the pint size game changer on it and just hammered the rifle into it, and it was really nice and stable. So I got my hits on that. And again, these are 360 yards and 427 yards. And you had to shoot each one. And for this one, my, I don't have my dope written down here for them, but my dope was 1.5 and 2.1. So it, in the reticle, this scope has an H59 reticle in it. So 1.5 is really clear, and with the size of the targets, I didn't worry about 2.1, I just worried about 2. So I didn't need to dial, so I could save a little bit of time switching between the two targets. I could stay in the scope and just move over and hammer them. So I chose to hold on this stage, And I was able to get those two shots relatively quickly. It's really straightforward, just a straight up barricade. From there, I moved over to the next spot, which the next spot was ports in the wall. And the ports were rather large, but they were bordered by one bys or two bys. I can't remember. So they were the ports were thick. Mm-hmm. They weren't just regular cutouts. So I had to take the game changer and flip it upside down. I dropped it in there again, rammed the rifle in. Luckily, the port was large enough that the scope would fit through. And I ran this with no bipod on the front end. I took the bipod off before I started. So ran the rifle through, got it nice and stable there. Again, two shots, no problems. And then I had a little bit of a brain short circuit because you have to go up to the next stage. And I'm used to running more tactical stages where you retain your rifle. You just orient it muzzle up and then move around. So if you have to move up range, you usually just put your muzzle straight up in the air with the bolt back on an empty chamber and you move. This one, they wanted you to take the rifle and actually set it up on the ledge that was on the next level. So I immediately came out of the port, turned and started to move, and they had to yell at me to set the rifle up. So I had to back up, turn, orient the rifle correctly downrange, set it up onto the next level. Again, I didn't have a bipod on it, so I had to make sure I didn't screw everything up. Set it down, and then run around and up to the next level and retrieve the rifle. And that's where we encountered the rope. This was basically one of the large size manila ropes, either climbing rope or barge mooring rope kind of thing. And it was nailed across in a draping fashion, mm-hmm. about 4 feet high or so, somewhere about that. Yeah. It was above regular, if you picture a regular fence railing or a regular stair railing, it was about, I don't know, 8-9 inches above that. So that one, again, I took the game changer. I just threw it over the rope, drove the rifle into it, and then I put all the weight I could muster into the rifle. Really took all the tension out of the rope, well, all the slack out of the rope, tensioned the rope, and then got my two hits there. Came off of that, and the biggest thing I was worried about was dropping the game changer off the rope, because if I fumbled it when I took it off the rope, it was going to go straight down, all the way down to the ground, and I wouldn't have it for the last stage where I really needed it. So the last position was the rooftop, and it's a fairly standard rooftop, mm-hmm. just a really shallow pitch on the roof. So it was easy to get up there. I threw the game changer right on the crown of the roof, threw the rifle up there, stabilized it, triggered off my last two shots, and stood up and actually was amazed that I cleaned that stage with all that movement, all that position mm-hmm. changing, holding instead of dialing, and I somehow managed to clean it. So felt pretty good. Came off of that with a smile on my face and went back, set the rifle down, and then picked up the camera.
Yeah, so this was the last stage. It was hot. I was tired. So in my head, I was like, if I hit one, it's going to be a great day. There had been some elements that I had never done, never shot off a rope before. Never tried to knock myself out before, so I didn't do that thing, thankfully, but that was always a concern of mine. So I missed the first two shots. Someone made a wind correction for me, so I got some hits off the porthole, went up and actually got hit off the rope, got up to the roof, and had a misfeed, or a double feed or something. So I had to unload, clear my feed, and reload, and then still got my last hit. And so to me, that made my match, because I had never been able to do that before in the time and bring it, get the, oh my gosh, I got to fix this, and settle it back down, calm down, and hit the shot while holding on top of it, because the targets were perfect for my reticle. It fit perfectly in a square with the wind hold and the hold for the second target. So to me, that was the cherry on top of my match.
So again, that was the last mm-hmm. of the stages. And then everybody packed up. We got our gear back. I think our squad was probably the last squad to finish.
By hours. Like, some people were done like at 1:15, and I was like 4:15 when we were done. So I'm not quite sure what happened there. But, you know, sometimes it's nice to have the range to yourself. So,
So we went back through the gear in the car, came back to the barn where they did the awards presentation, and found out that I had a 19th place finish overall, and it was between me and Frank Galley for top mill and LEO shooter, and Frank beat me by 1 point for that. He was shooting a new JP 224 Valkyrie, so interesting rifle overall, so he was a little bit handicapped by the wind, I think, as well. I was shooting a brand new rifle, so I was a little bit handicapped by my experience with it, but overall, the rifle performed very, very well. You finished
46th out of 69
shooters,
which to me, that's the best I've ever placed. So I, like I said, very happy with that. And that truly is just experience. And places really, the number one shooter only dropped 4 points or four shots the whole time. And places truly were 1 point each. So it was really a tight placing match. But gosh, it was so much fun. And so much fun.
And Craig from Area 149 was the top shooter overall. So he did an absolutely excellent job shooting in some pretty adverse wind conditions. But the absolutely amazing thing about this match is when we did the initial match briefing, Gary Larson asked everybody to hold up their hands if they had never shot a match before, if this was their first match, and a lot of hands went up. So it's really one of these environments where it really fosters bringing in new shooters and getting them comfortable with the sport. And hopefully it will be a springboard for them to continue to shoot more Guardians and get into PRS and NRL series competition. So I absolutely love to see that. We see new faces. We see old faces that keep coming back to the same Guardians over and over again. I think Gary said he has something like an 80% return rate. So we get a lot of the same shooters that come back. And I've said this before, I'll say it again. The Guardian has a totally different vibe. And part of that is, I think, because the shooters that are there for the love of the sport. They're not there to make money. They're not there to clean the prize table and go sell a bunch of stuff on Gunbroker or Sniper's Hide or eBay or wherever. They are there because they love shooting, they love interacting with other shooters, and they love helping new shooters. We had a lot of shooters that were double duty as shooters and ROs, because each squad had their own ROs as well as the stage RO. So there was a lot of work being put in by everybody, and everybody was having a ton of fun. Even on the stages where we were having a whole kind of problems, we were struggling, everybody was still smiling, everybody was still joking and having fun. So it was an absolutely awesome environment. It's something that we love to get behind, and we love to shoot as many of them as we possibly can. As I mentioned, there is not a big prize table for where you place. The prizes that are donated to the Guardian are raffled off, and all that money goes to help support Bethany Christian Services, which is an absolutely amazing organization that helps children find their forever homes. And we'll leave a link down below to Bethany. That way you guys can go check them out and know where the Guardian money is going to. So not only are you participating in a great event that really helps get new shooters into our sport and get them excited about precision shooting, but on the flip side of it, you are helping a very noble and worthy cause. So it's something that we really, really are proud and honored to be a continued part of, and we love being invited out to shoot these matches. Now, when we went through the awards portion of it and they were tabulating the scores, Gary went through and he told his key story to everybody that's in attendance. This is kind of a repeat thing that he's done periodically throughout the matches. It kind of started as a casual thing where just shooters would be around him and he would talk about his history as a foster child. And then it kind of evolved into something that now I think he kind of formally does at each Guardian that he is in attendance at. And we were happy to be able to capture that on camera. And once we get done here, we will play it at the end so you guys can get a little bit of an idea of the history and why Gary has such a passion for what he does for this event and for the agency that it supports. So please make sure you guys check that out at the end.
And while we're kind of talking about that, there is a match in Georgia in September, and it still has open spots. So if you are watching and you hear Gary's testimony and realize you just really want to do something like this, you know, September in Georgia shouldn't be that hot. So go on down and have a good time and meet some of the people we get to shoot with every time.
Yep. So that is the Guardian Long Range match this last August 24th in Ardmore, Tennessee at King Bee Farm. I really look forward to my next chance to go shoot that venue. Mm-hmm. Clifton Reeser from Reeser Precision was basically the head guy in charge, mm-hmm. organizing the whole event, making sure the match ran smoothly. And Clifton did an excellent job. We really only had downtime a couple of times where they had to run down and fix targets. And it was done in a very quick and efficient way, and we were back up and shooting. And with how that facility was laid out and how many different target positions and how many moving parts were going, being able to get through all of that with no downtime. And actually, we got lunch mm-hmm. on time.
Yeah, lunch was catered.
Lunch showed up before everybody actually figured out. We had box lunches, chicken sandwiches from Chick-fil-A. Mm-hmm. So really good food, and had a bag of chips and a chocolate chip cookie. And
it was the cookie that turned John's day around. So this melty chocolate chip cookie just did it for him.
I'm going to have to start eating chocolate chip cookies before I shoot the match, and we'll see if that starts things off on a good foot. But it was nice that that stuff showed up before... everybody was looking around, wondering when lunch was going to be. And then there was always water. Water was available at pretty much every shooting point, which that is critically important in any match, but especially in a summer match mm-hmm. when you're in the heat. Being able to just continually drink water and not even think about it, just grab a bottle of water. For those of you guys that are unfamiliar with shooting matches in the heat, it's very easy to start concentrating on your performance and concentrating on the match and totally forget to drink water. Mm-hmm. But I challenge you to drink as much water as you possibly can when you're shooting one of these matches, because staying hydrated keeps everything moving. You don't want to be that guy that causes the whole match to go down because of a heat casualty, that they've got to go evac and do all this stuff. So make sure that you drink water at those matches. And match directors, make sure you provide water. I know it's an added expense, but you got to provide water for people at these matches. So that is it for the Guardian. Do you have anything extra you want to add?
Not really. It was a great time, you guys. I can't stress it enough. The environment isn't... It's not like these big money ticket point matches that, you know, accumulate over the year for this final series. It truly is. There is a spirit of camaraderie. Everyone was getting help on their win calls. If you have never shot a match before, but you kind of know what you're doing, this is the place to do it, because people are going to help. People are going to loan gear. And we even had a young shooter. I don't know how old Blake was, but he was in our squad, and he was a young kid, and a teenager at least, I'm going to say. And everyone was, so he did great. I think he even outshot his dad. So just, if that's how we're going to keep the sport going, is if we get these younger shooters in and create this environment where it is friendly and open, and how the girls are going to come too. And we had our own porta potty. Thank you very much. So just, guys, I can't stress it enough. Fill up this September match, make it happen. I challenge all of you.
So real quick, I'll talk about the gear and then we'll be done here. I was shooting the Ultimatum Deadline build with the MDT ESS chassis and the folding stock. And we have an Excalibur 6.5 Creedmoor barrel on here and the MDT brake and the Night Force Attacker F1 5-25 on here. Overall, the rifle worked very, very well. I've got a TriggerTech Diamond trigger in here. And everything worked exactly the way I expected to. The rail on here, we had an MDT rail on here. I put a longer Henderson Precision rail on it because we are testing this out. And the ability just to put my bipod wherever I need it to be really helped out. And the ability to quickly eject the bipod if I needed to get it off the rifle because I made a poor planning decision was great overall. So we'll talk a little bit more about the rifle in a coming video, but I just wanted to give a quick rundown so you guys know what's going on. Again, it was in 6.5 Creedmoor, so it performed great. Sarah was shooting her Remington 700 in 308 with a 20-inch barrel in Ashbury Precision Ordnance chassis, and a US Optics LR17 scope on it. And apparently that, other than a couple of bobbles here and there, it ran pretty well.
Right. And I think the two mag issues I had were from me loading the mag, not physically putting the bullets in the magazine, but weight loading the mag. Both of the places I had definitely had weight on the rooftop and the pipe. Yes. Mm-hmm. And once I talked to Scott Whitehead about it, he said that happens to him every time. Mm-hmm. So it was a user error and I just have to change what I'm doing.
Yep. So that is the Guardian Long Range. If you guys have any questions about anything that we've covered or the match in general, please leave a comment down in the comment section below or send it to us on Facebook or Twitter. If you guys are listening to the podcast or listening to this on your favorite podcast app, you can send questions to us at 8541tactical@gmail.com. If you like the video, please make sure you like, share, and subscribe. Don't forget to check us out over on full30.com. Please subscribe to us over there in case YouTube decides to delete this video. It will still be over there. And until next time, get out and shoot.
On our shirts, and you'll actually see in some of the products we do, there's a house key that we talk about. And so the key story, just real quick, while we're waiting for Clifton to come on back in, the key story is, it's my story, and I was a foster kid from the time I was 12 and until I was getting ready to age out of the foster care system. And the reason why I was in foster homes wasn't because I was in a good place, right? Kids don't end up in foster care because they have loving, caring parents who are doing the right thing. I was one of those kids that was neglected and abused, okay? And at 12, which if any of you guys are parents and have 12-year-olds, it's tough enough raising 12-year-olds or being 12, and then you have this dysfunction. One of the things that happened to me in that crazy time of my life is I got taken out of that dysfunction and put in the care of the state. Which sounds like a good thing, except for I went from a kid with a consistent amount of dysfunction to a consistent amount of unknowing, to where I didn't know where my family was going to be or if I was even going to have parents. So from the time I was 12 to 18, I was in and out of different foster homes. And what would happen is I would go into a foster home, I would get placed, and I would screw up or I would do something stupid, and what the foster parents would do is they would take me and return me back to the orphanage. So much like, you know, a bad product, I continued to get returned for a refund because I was defective. And that, today I'm 42 years old, I still struggle with the effects that has on me. And what I mean by that is the level of connecting and staying connected and feeling like I have permanence is something that I struggle with. And at the age of, my senior year in high school, I'm getting ready to age out, go into the military. I hated my foster mom. She really didn't like me. I was just biding my time until I left for the Army. And I started sleeping on my buddy's couches and their, you know, cars. I didn't want to be there. And my caseworker at the time, a gentleman by the name of Pete, who's just, he was just 10 or 11 years older than me. He was my caseworker. He said, Gary, he was a caseworker for Bethany Christian Services. He said, Gary, if I allow you to just sleep in people's cars and in random houses, I'm failing to do my job as your caseworker. And I'm like, I'm freaking not going back there because I hate her. And in 2 months, I leave for Benning anyway. So whatever, right? What happened was he said, I got it approved through Bethany for you to come stay with us for a couple weeks until we can find you one of your baseball buddies or an ROTC buddy for you to stay with. But I can't allow you to do this whole transient thing. So his wife was 8 months pregnant with her second child at the time, right? They're 27 and 28. And they took in a senior in high school with a long history of being stupid and making bad choices, right? And a couple weeks turned into a couple more weeks when things kept falling through, turned into a couple more weeks to the point where they said, this is God telling us that you need to be here. When we've made so many freaking hard, like, plans and it all falls through, there's a reason. And the reason was I was meant to be with them. And what's really cool is they gave me a house key. Simple house key. And I would go to school, I would come back, and I would give the key back to them. Because in my mind, it was their key, and I didn't want to keep it. Because I didn't understand that it was forever. And the work that you guys are doing here, you are placing keys in the hands of so many children, many of which are better looking than me. But the life trajectory that you're doing here through this creative ministry, regardless of where you are in your walk with God, He's using you now in this moment to do awesome things. And I can't thank you guys enough for being a part of this ministry and the work that we do. This year we've raised so much money, and 100% of that money is going to help other kids get a key. And a part of this story I often don't share because it's kind of edgy. And some of you have heard it. But when I moved in, I got to stay in the basement. I got a futon, and I got a little place down there. And when I was in the basement, much like these little air vents here, very similar to these air vents here, I used to sneak and hide something in those air vents. Dating myself, it was a VHS cassette. But the VHS cassette had content on there that's not appropriate for some of the young adults in the room. But that was my little stash. And who in the hell would ever find that? Well, I come home from school one day, and sitting on the kitchen table is that freaking tape. But more importantly was what was on the top of the tape was a sticky note. And the sticky note just said three words. We love you. And it wasn't, you're horrible, we're embarrassed, you've disappointed us. It was, we love you. And at the end of that sentence was a period. Not an ellipsis where we love you if or we love you when. It's just, we freaking love you. And you guys are doing that. And I can't thank you enough. So thank you guys so much for being a part of this.